Friends, we've come to the Dhammapada session, the fourth in a series of 10. Today's topic is vegetarianism compulsory to be a Buddhist. I shall now read the English portion of today's reading. Yeah? Dhammapada verse 163. It is easy to do things that are bad and unbeneficial to oneself, but it is indeed most difficult to do things that are beneficial and good. One day, when the Buddha was giving a discourse in the Veluvana monastery, Devadatta came to him and suggested that since the Buddha was getting old, the duties of the order should be entrusted to him, Devadatta. But the enlightened one did not accept his proposal, and Devadatta felt very insulted. From that time, he felt very bitter, even tried to kill the Buddha, but all his attempts failed. Later, he tried another tactic. This time, he came to him and proposed 5 rules of discipline for the bhikkhus to observe throughout their lives. He proposed 1. That bhikkhus should live in the forest. 2. That they should live only on food received on alms rounds. 3. That they should wear robes made only from pieces of cloth collected from rubbish heaps. 4. That they should reside under trees. And 5. That they should not take fish or meat. The Buddha did not have any objections to these rules and did not restrict those who were personally willing to observe them. But for various valid considerations, he was not prepared to introduce these rules of discipline as binding laws on the order in general. Devadatta claimed that the rules proposed by him were much better than the existing rules of discipline, and some new bhikkhus agreed with him. One day, on being questioned by the enlightened one, Devadatta admitted that he was trying to create a schism in the order. Devadatta was advised that it was a very serious misdeed, but he paid no heed to the advice. Later, Devadatta informed Venerable Ananda that from that day onwards, he would observe all his religious activities and perform monastic duties separately from the order instituted by the Buddha. Ananda then reported the matter to the master. On hearing this, the Buddha reflected, Devadatta is committing a very serious misdeed in dividing the Sangha community, and he will have to suffer for his evil intention. Then the enlightened one said, for a virtuous person, it is easy to do good deeds, and it is difficult to do evil. But for an evil one, it is easy to do evil and difficult to do good. Indeed, it is easy to do something which is not beneficial, but it is very difficult to do something which is good and wholesome. Then Devadatta, followed by a group of bhikkhus, broke off from the order and went to Gayasisa. However, the two chief disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, were able to make many of those bhikkhus realize their mistakes, and they returned to the Buddha. End of reading. This was translated by Venerable K. Sri Dhammananda. Bhante, please. Thank you.
Is vegetarianism compulsory to be a Buddhist? The story to the Dhammapada verse number 163 raised many questions. One of them is it necessary to be a vegetarian to follow the path of the Buddha? Today, in this talk, I'm representing the Theravada Buddhist school point of view. However, there might be other Buddhist schools who have different views on this matter. There are three aspects to this talk. First of all, I would like to discuss why Buddha did not include these five rules suggested by Devadatta into monastic codes of discipline. Second, I will spend some time to discuss what if Buddha were to make vegetarianism compulsory. Here, we are going to understand the probable outcomes. In third stage, I'm going to share how the Buddha approached vegetarianism in a very systematic, practical, and rational way, which is a gradual approach. First of all, let's understand these five rules which were suggested by Devadatta, as you all heard. One day he went to the Buddha and suggested these five rules. Monks throughout their lives should live in the forest. They should not live in the cities. Monks throughout their lives, they should depend on alms food. In other words, they should collect their foods in alms round, and they should not accept any foods given by the lay people in their houses or brought to the monasteries. Monks throughout their lives, they should make their own robes by collecting the discarded pieces of clothes from rubbish heaps. They should not accept any robe given by lay people. Monks, throughout their lives, they should reside under the trees, and they should not live in the buildings such as monasteries and houses given to them by lay people. The fifth one, throughout the lives, monks should be vegetarian. They should not eat any fish or meat or any other non-vegetarian foods. So these are the five rules suggested by Devadatta, and he insisted that these were to be included in monastic codes of discipline. Buddha did not have any rejection to anyone who is willing to follow these rules, but he did not want to make them compulsory. He said, whoever wishes to adhere to these rules, they are free to do so. And if anyone does not want to follow these five rules, they are also free not to follow them. The question here is, why didn't the Buddha make these five rules compulsory? There can be many reasons. Out of these, I would like to point out three most important reasons. First of all, these five rules have nothing to do with fundamentals requirements in order to attain enlightenment. What is the purpose of following the Dhamma? Why did the Buddha design the Noble Eightfold Path? That is for the purpose of attaining perfect enlightenment. So if the enlightenment is the goal of the Buddhist practice, these five rules have nothing fundamental in order to achieve that goal. It doesn't make anyone more pure or wholesome just because someone lives in the forest. Some monks might find it is comfortable and conducive for their practice if they were to live in the forest. But there might be some other monks who find it is more comfortable and conducive if they were to live in a village or in the city. So living in the forest or living in the city does not make anything wholesome or pure or spiritually advanced, but that entirely depends on the individuals. Just because someone lives in the forest or in the city, that alone doesn't make anything different in his spiritual practice of cultivating one's own virtue, concentration, and wisdom. In the same manner, it doesn't make any difference whether you wear a robe made of the clothes, the pieces of clothes collected from rubbish heap, or whether you are wearing a robe given by someone, or it also doesn't make any difference whether you eat vegetarian food or non-vegetarian food. All these are basic needs for survival. So this is the first reason why Buddha did not make them compulsory, because it doesn't have any direct impact and they are not fundamental at all. So Buddha gave the freedom for the monastic order either to follow them or not to follow them. Of course, there are monks and nuns who follow these rules. There are also monks and nuns who do not follow these rules. The second reason why Buddha did not make these rules compulsory is again a very practical one. These five rules are related to the most basic needs of survival: food, shelter, clothes, and medicines. These are the four basic requisites to survive. So the monks and nuns, they depend on these four for their sustain. So all these five rules are related to these most basic fundamental requisites. Now, if Buddha were to make these five rules compulsory, saying that all the monks and nuns must live in the forest under the trees and must be completely vegetarian and collect the foods going on alms round and if it is the case, then of course the monastic life can be very hard to live, and probably not many people want to be monks and nuns because it's so difficult to live as a monk or a nun. Thereby, what will happen when there are no monastic community? Then of course the dispensation of the Buddha could have come to an end, because the monks and nuns, they are the primary sources of the Dhamma. They practice the Dhamma and also they propagate the Dhamma. Throughout many centuries before the Dhamma was written down, it was transferred from one generation to another generation through oral tradition. And also it is spread far and wide in the world because of the missionary monks. And if Buddha were to make these rules compulsory, and not many would have become monks and nuns, and thereby the Buddha's dispensation would have come to an end a long ago. This is another valid reason. The third reason, these five rules suggested by Devadatta belong to or tend to self-mortification. In the time of the Buddha, there were two popular extremes. One is Attakilamatana Yoga, self-mortification. The other one is the self-indulgence, Kama Sukhalikana Yoga. As a prince, Buddha had the maximum enjoyment, gratifying sensual faculties to the maximum level. After renouncing his kingdom and the princely enjoyment, he went to the other extreme, self-mortification. Throughout 6 years, he tried to achieve enlightenment by following that path, but it did not lead to supreme enlightenment. So Buddha knew through his own experience, this extreme asceticism leads only to futile end, to torture the body and inflict more suffering. And they do not lead to any spiritual cultivation or development of the mental faculties. So since these rules are more inclined towards the asceticism or the extreme self-mortification, the Buddha did not want to include them in the monastic codes of discipline. Buddha avoided all the extremes and he encouraged the middle path, Majjhima Patipada. Now, let's imagine what would have happened or what would be the probable outcome if Buddha were to make vegetarianism compulsory? This is just one of the five rules. As we already discussed, if Buddha were to make this compulsory, one of the probability is that Buddhism could have confined to a small community. In the time of the Buddha, as well as today, majority of the human population, they are not vegetarian. So the vegetarian population is the minority. So if you put up a rule that you must be strict vegetarian in order to be a Buddhist, then the Buddha's teachings could be followed by only the minority. Thereby, it could have confined to a minority group. It could not have spread far and wide in the world. And this, of course, is evidence again when we look at some other religions as well. I do not want to label any of these religions, but if we look at it generally, we can see some of these strict rules imposed by certain religions make themselves confined to smaller areas or smaller communities. For example, there might be some religions. In order to become a follower of that religion, they had to be born in a particular race. So religion is a matter of birth. So by being born into a particular ethnic group, that person become the member of that particular religion. There's no any other way someone to convert it into that particular religion. So such religions, of course, remain always as a religion of a race or religion of a particular ethnic group. Similarly, if Buddha were to make this a compulsory rule, and this is one of the probable outcome. The second probability is, again, Buddhism could not have spread into some other places on the earth because of this strict rule. For example, if anyone, any human beings who live in Arctic region, North Pole, like Eskimos, if someone from that region were to adopt Buddhism and follow the path for the purpose of attaining enlightenment, it is not possible, because many of these human beings, they survived in meat or fish. So by making vegetarianism compulsory and the first rule to be accepted, simply make these people do not have any access to Dhamma. And again, in olden days, sometimes because of climate conditions, in certain period of the year, depend on vegetarian food alone was not practical. For example, during winter period, it's difficult to find vegetable. So people, they depend on vegetables as well as meat and fish and other non-vegetarian food. And also, the food is mainly produced in that local area. So we did not have transportation systems like today. So those human beings who survived whatever the food available in those areas, and if we were to make vegetarianism compulsory, they would not have adopted the Dhamma. Thereby, they will be deprived practicing the Noble Eightfold Path to attain enlightenment. What will happen to the monastic community then? Again, the monastic community also would not have, I cannot say not totally survived, but flourished. I would say that maybe they would not have flourished, or they would have faced extreme difficulties. For example, monks and nuns, they depend on the lay Buddhist community for their food. Of course, monks and nuns are not allowed to ask any foods and drinks from lay community, except that particular monk or nun has health issues. Otherwise, we cannot say, I want this food or that food. The simple practice is, the monks and nuns, they will go on their arms round, and the people will offer whatever the food that they can spare, that they can give. So if we were to demand that we want this food or that food, that is going to be unnecessary burden to the society. As the Buddha pointed out, the monks and nuns, yatapi bambaro puppang vanna gandang ahetya paleti rasa madaya evangame munichari. The monks and nuns should live, depend on a village or community without becoming a burden to these people. And he says, he gives a simile, like a bee collects pollen without harming the beauty of the flower or without harming the fragrance of the flower. Similarly, monks and nuns should survive without becoming a burden to the lay community. So in this case, if Buddha were to made vegetarianism compulsory, and then when the monks and nuns go on their arms round, and they would have these practical issues, and thereby again the monastic life would have become very difficult to live, and many would not want to be monks and nuns. Now, let's see how Buddha approached this question of vegetarianism. As you already noticed, he did not make it compulsory. Nevertheless, when we look at the path of the Buddha, and we can see, in fact, Buddha is such a wonderful teacher. No doubt that he is known as Satta Deva Manusana, the teacher of humans and devas, who is full of great compassion and unfathomable wisdom. And his great compassion and wisdom, and which goes along with his teaching, when we analyze, when we try to understand this, in fact, we can see Buddha had a very rational, very effective approach to vegetarianism. Now, the Buddha's teaching is known as gradual path, gradual development. And we need to understand it as a path of transformation. If we accept the Buddha's path as a path of transformation, it means any human being who is willing to undertake the path can be transformed. So the first of all, the most important thing that we must do here, then we must open the path for everyone. If we want human beings to be transformed, we must open the path of the Buddha to criminals. Otherwise, criminals cannot be transformed. We must open the path of the Buddha for both vegetarian and non-vegetarian. Otherwise, we cannot transform these human beings. So if we look at it in that way, you might see how the Buddha gradually encouraged vegetarianism towards the end of his three steps of the path. Here, there are three stages into this. The first stage, whoever wants to be a Buddhist, he or she must abide by the principle of non-killing. The first precept is to refrain from all the killings. This is the first precept. Here, this is compulsory. Without observing this precept, we cannot accept that person as a Buddhist. So here, killing for the food is also included. So whatever the reason here, and you must refrain from killing. So this stage is compulsory to be a Buddhist. Now there is second stage. What is the second stage? Second stage is becoming the cause of direct killing. And this is also compulsory in order to become a Buddhist. It means a Buddhist should refrain from becoming the cause of direct killing. In Vanijja Sutta, the Buddha prohibited five types of trades. Out of five, two are related to the meat industry. So here, Buddhists should refrain from selling meat or any other body parts of the animals. This is one. The other one is, Buddhists also should refrain from raising animals for slaughtering purpose. And this included in the Noble Eightfold Path. When we talk about Samma Ajiva, right livelihood, followers of the Buddha were encouraged to find a peaceful, suitable, righteous way of living, refraining from killing animals or refraining from selling their meat, raising animals for the slaughtering purpose. So in these two aspects, direct killing as well as becoming the cause of direct killing are to be avoided. Both steps are compulsory in order to be a Buddhist. Now there is a third aspect to it. This is becoming the cause of indirect killing. What is this? As the argument goes, the butchers provide the meat because people eat meat. So if there is no demand for the meat, the butchers will not kill the animals. That is true. So as long as there is a demand for the meat, there is butchery. So there will be people who will kill. However, this is indirect cause of killing. It means when we buy meat or fish in the market, even though you are not killing directly, even though you do not become direct killing with your awareness that directly linked to the, but indirectly you are also becoming part of it. Now, when it comes to this particular cause, which is the cause of indirect killing, the Buddha did not make it compulsory for the simple reasons which we have just mentioned. In Jivaka Sutta, the Dr. Jivaka went to the Buddha and he directly asked this question, whether it is all right to eat meat. Buddha said, there are three instances that meat should not be eaten. What are these three instances? Seen, heard, and suspect. What it means here, if a particular being is slaughtered for one's own consumption, and then if you see it, if you hear, or if you suspect, in such a case, you should not take any meat or fish. In other terms, Buddha discouraged killing any living being. Not discouraged, Buddha prohibited, in fact, here. Buddha prohibit monks and nuns accepting any non-vegetarian foods which was specifically prepared for them by killing animals. So if a monk or a nun were to see or were to hear or were to even suspect that particular meat was specifically prepared for them and slaughtered for them, and then in that case, that meat should not be eaten. However, meat may be eaten if not seen, heard, or suspected. Here in that case, a monk were to go on arms round, and someone were to offer some non-vegetarian food, and it was not a planned, and a particular living being was not specifically killed for the purpose of this monk's food. And it so happened that non-vegetarian food was offered. So monk also does not suspect that it is specifically killed for him. And if he is very clear about these three aspects of seen, heard, and suspect, then that non-vegetarian food may be eaten. Towards the end of this discourse, there is something very remarkable and worth to read. At the end of the discourse, he says, if anyone were to kill a living being to prepare the food for the Tathagata or his disciples, in that case, that person create dark karmic forces in five stages. And he says, when one says, go and bring that animal, and he is making demerits. When that animal is dragged to the killing place, demerit is produced. When one says, kill that animal, the demerit is produced, karmic forces are produced. And when that animal is being slaughtered and experiencing pain and suffering, and at that stage also negative karmic forces are produced. And when the food prepared from that flesh or meat was served to the monks and Tathagata, and that point the negative karmic forces are produced. So Buddha says, if anyone were to kill a living being in the name of the Buddha or his disciples to feed them, that person is creating a negative karmic force in five stages. What does it mean? He completely against for any kind of killing. However, as we discussed already, and if any monk or nun were to go on alms round, or if any lay person were to offer non-vegetarian food, which is not specifically killed for this monk or nun, in such a case, that can be accepted. So this is the third level. Now, if you look at the Buddha's approach, rather than making vegetarianism compulsory at beginning, rather than making it the entry point to become a Buddhist, Buddha make it entry point as killing and direct cause of killing. These two compulsory to be a Buddhist. In other terms, to start following the path of the Buddha, the first two requirements, to refrain from killing and becoming the direct cause of killing. After that, you start following the noble path. When you cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path and spiritual faculties, eventually you will come to develop your ethical, spiritual, and intellectual capacities and abilities. And you will understand the Four Noble Truths eventually. You will come to a point to understand the suffering. Suffering in its gross level and subtle level. Suffering in its human form and animal form. Suffering in its different realms, different depth, and different width. When you understand the suffering, and then you also will understand the cause of the suffering. There are many causes of the suffering, as the Buddha pointed out, and he singled out the craving, which is rooted in ignorance, and out of that, there are many other forms of causes and conditions coming to suffering. So when you understand the suffering and causes of the suffering, you also will understand the end of the suffering and the path leading to the end of the suffering. At this stage, if any human being understand and come to a point that I do not want to be a direct cause of suffering to another or indirect cause of suffering to another, and I do not want to be part of this process of causing suffering, and such a human being may choose to be vegetarian. And that comes with understanding. And that will come with Dhamma practice, with deep understanding and compassion. So here, the vegetarianism is encouraged, not compulsory. Why it is not compulsory? For the reasons which I have just mentioned at the very beginning of this talk. Okay, I think this is enough as a talk. We can open this for a Q&A.